This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 259 of the All Souls podcast.
Nope.
I have never done that. That is weird.
That is a first.
That is weird.
You literally couldn't have been more wrong.
Well, that's the easiest thing to identify. The funny thing is we've done now, this is number 259 of the Outlander podcast. And the funny thing is I have a hard time saying All Souls podcast when we actually do the All Souls podcast. I always say Outlander.
We did just have a really All Souls heavy weekend.
It has to be that because gracious. Okay, let's try that again. Welcome to episode 259 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So do we have any announcements?
No, the only announcement this week is they released, Entertainment Weekly released some new photos of Rollo.
Aw. Yeah, that was cool. It's so cute. I know.
Yeah, so cute. And of course, you know, John Bell. He was there too. But, you know, gotta love Rollo. He's my fave.
Before we get to our main chunk of content, wanted to remind you that you can connect with us in all the places. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at Outlander Pod. And don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating if you love our show. And of course, some feedback. We love to hear from you.
And now on to our read-along. That was really dramatic.
It's not quite Halloween, Sam.
It's getting there. This week, we are beginning part 10, y'all. Part 10, and we are officially two-thirds of the way done with this book. Like, we are working our way down the other side of the hill. Like, I noticed it a lot with Dragonfly. No, not Dragonfly. Voyager, that was the last one we did. Don't laugh at me. Just the way that the book feels, the further you get along and you're like, there's so much less book left now. So we are, like I said, we are two-thirds done with this book. So we are in the, not the home stretch, but we are definitely working in a downward motion here. Okay. So part 10, Impaired Relations. And we will begin with chapter 42 entitled Moonlight.
It's September 1769. Now, regarding the title, Martina P. writes, "When I started reading, I was immediately delighted to learn that we are in Jamie's point of view for part of the chapter. It doesn't happen very often in Outlander, but I adore it so much when it does. I love being in Jamie's head and getting a glimpse of his inner thoughts." Brianna is on the ridge with Jamie and Claire, and it is night. Jamie, they're all asleep, or most of them are asleep.
It's barely night. We're working our way towards dawn.
Jamie gently wakes Brianna and asks her if she wants to go hunting with him. And of course he tells her to wear her breeks. And that just makes me laugh because he would have been the first person to say how obscene it would have been.
Can I say, before you get much deeper into this, how much I love this chapter? Just because, like, it's not even a super long chapter, but what I love about this chapter is I believe in the series, and this is the fourth book in the series, this is the first time we have ever seen Claire from a third person.
Yeah, I love it.
Because almost every chapter she's in is first person. So this is the first time that she is not the narrator of this chapter and she is described.
So she gets dressed and Brianna goes out to use the...
You don't have anything to say about what I said?
I agree. It's really a treat, not only to get Jamie's POV, but also to get, like, look through a window at Claire. It's kind of special because so many people love Claire and we love hearing the story. That's what we're used to, is hearing the story through her eyes, through her senses. By getting an outside view into Claire, or of Claire, it kind of, not that she's not human, we know she's human, but it humanizes her even more. It makes her more mortal, you know? That's how I feel about it. It makes me love her more.
Yeah.
So when Brianna goes outside to use the privy, Diana describes the darkness and how bright the stars are. So because of light pollution, it can be really hard to clearly see the night sky in many places. But if you've ever been up to the mountains, are, you know, a perfect example of a great place to be able to see the night sky. I remember, I think I was in Switzerland. So this would have been back in the 90s at some point, that I was in Switzerland staying with my host family. I don't know, because they lived in a mountain village. I'm not sure if I just was out with them just, you know, not too far from their home, or if it was when we were doing, I guess you could call it church camp. My host mother was a pastor. One of very few female pastors in Switzerland. But anyway, of course, Protestant. And I guess every summer they go away for like a week or so to like some kind of camp. And since I was with them, I went with them and I helped out with the talent show and stuff. It was fun. I helped out with the kids. But I don't know if it was at camp, which was in the mountains. I mean, pretty much everywhere in Switzerland's mountains. But I remember it was pointed out to me, something called the Milchstraße. And I was like, the huh? And then I tried to like translate it. And I was like, wait, Milk Street. That doesn't make sense. But looking up at something, I'm like, wait, Milky Way? And I was like, holy heck. Like, I didn't know that you could see the Milky Way if you were part of the Milky Way. I didn't know. I thought it was something you had to, like, they had just named because we were in it. I had no clue. But anyway, looking up and seeing, like, you know, all the dots and the stars and the, you know, whatever was up there among that like streak of gases, right? Kind of, it looks like a smudge almost. That's how you can see the Milky Way. And I thought, it almost looks fake. I'm like, really? I mean, we can literally sit here, stand here, whatever, and look up and see that. Well, yes, if you're not around too much light pollution. And maybe it's the time of year. I have absolutely no idea. But it was fascinating. I had no idea that we could view it with our naked eyes. Have you ever been, I know as kids and we've had times to, you know, see different things with our family or camping or whatever, but do you remember a time, whether it was a trip, camping, whatever, that you were able to see just like the huge difference between city light and then lack of city light?
Oh yeah. When I was 20 something, I was probably 23. Lene and I went to Hawaii. And when we were on Kauai, we were staying at these condos that were on the north side of the island. And in front of where the condos were, there was this big grassy field. And there was very few lights. There weren't any like street lights or anything like that. So Lene and I grabbed some towels because we didn't have any blankets, some towels, and we hiked out to the little grassy spot and sat on it and were able to just lay down and look up, and you could see that like it looks kind of foggy in the middle and all the stars. And we watched a satellite go across the sky, and there were just, you know, shooting stars all night long. And shooting stars happen all the time. We just don't, when you live in the city, you just can't see them. But what finally drove us in that night, because it was so fascinating, was that I was being eaten alive by mosquitoes.
I was about to say, is this one of the days that you got mosquito bit?
Oh, that was the day. That was the beginning. I got bit by mosquitoes every day of that trip. That was a bad day. The day that we kayaked down a, what do they call it? Like a calm jungle stream, which should be translated to mosquito infested water. That was another big bad day of mosquito bites all over my legs. Like I said, she came back like a golden goddess and I came back like a refugee.
You were a welt. And she was a golden goddess. You were one big welt.
I was scabby. I was just scabby. No, I was scratching them in my sleep. They were so bad.
More of why we love Diana. Quote, he knew she was there, of course, but she felt like an intruder, a voyeur. The more so when Claire's long, pale hand floated up from the quilts and touched his face with a tenderness that squeezed her heart. Unquote. Of course, that's Brianna watching her parents. Martina P. writes, it was interesting to me that Bree felt like a voyeur and an intruder watching a tender moment between her parents. It must be an unusual sight for her to see her mother being loved in such a way, and she's possibly comparing it to the emptiness of Claire's relationship to Frank. Cindy R. writes, Brianna's feeling like a voyeur as Jamie kisses Claire goodbye. It's hard to witness other people's intimacy, particularly one's parents. I think Bree's discomfort could be due to a number of reasons. One, seeing Claire with someone other than Frank. Two, the depth of the feeling displayed between Jamie and Claire, even though it was just a brief smooch on the forehead and touching of a cheek. Even to myself, it conveyed intense emotion. Three, perhaps some underlying longing for Roger and thoughts of their brief honeymoon, quote unquote. So this chapter is one long, beautiful description of the ridge and the morning and the forest. So Summer, I had missed this on other readings. As they get farther away from the cabin, all traces of civilization disappear. Quote, she wiped her hand on the skirts of her coat, feeling the prickly shape of the conker in her pocket. No horse chestnuts on these wooded slopes. That was an English tree planted by some expatriate in hope of creating a memory of home, a living link to another life. She uncurled her hand around it briefly, wondering whether her own links had been severed for good, then let it go and turned to follow her father uphill, unquote. Okay, that's a lot to unpack, first of all. Okay, first I had to look up conker.
Of course you did.
I never know what it was. So it's a synonym for horse chestnut.
Which makes sense because she just said horse chestnut.
Exactly. So they're one and the same. So I looked up conker and this is the same one, the same thing she picked up while she was with Roger in chapter 40. So as they were sitting under a horse chestnut tree, one fell as they were chatting privately before they'd moved to the shed. And she had picked it up and taken it with her. Further, in Outlander, chapter 28, Kisses and Drawers, Jamie tells Claire under the shade of a horse chestnut, quote, you weren't the first last I kissed, but I swear you'll be the last, unquote. In Dragonfly and Amber, chapter 36, Preston Pans, Jamie leads Claire under the, quote, drooping limbs of a huge horse chestnut tree, unquote, into a clearing where they make love. And later in chapter 44, in which quite a lot of things gang eggly, Jamie and Claire chat, quote, sheltering under a horse chestnut tree, unquote. So the thing that I didn't understand in chapter 41, do you remember that? Mm-hmm. Last chapter, it's been 2 weeks. No, it's been a week, but we recorded it 2 weeks ago. So the thing that I didn't understand, remember I said there's definitely something that's missing. Like, how did she get the ring? If she got the ring, how did she get the ring? You know, there's stuff missing from that chapter. Not just the scene, but also something like she's hella pissed or hella sad or hella mad or hella something that is not necessarily equating with what happened with Roger. It could definitely be part of it, but there's something that doesn't compute. And we talked about that. Okay. So the thing that I don't the thing that I didn't understand in chapter 41, it's explained here. Okay. Here's that line from chapter 41 that I did not understand. Quote, she patted the pocket of her coat to be sure she had money. She felt instead the prickly outline of a horse chestnut's hull and pulled her hand away as though she'd been burned. Unquote. What the hell, right? What does that mean? That was in 41. This is the same conker, or I mean, we're led to believe this is the conker that she'd taken from the place she and Roger had made love. So I went through and I found up until this book, all the mentions of horse nest, chestnut tree and conker. And I shared them here. And then finally, so we get a little bit of symbolism, maybe. But so we know that Jamie and Claire have had intimate conversations under horse chestnut trees. They've made love under horse chestnut trees. Same exact thing with Roger and Bree. They've had intimate conversations under the tree. And although they actually made love in the shed, still she carried that with her. So there was part of a horse chestnut tree with them. And that is what she took with her.
They decided to have sex while sitting under a horse chestnut tree.
Oh, yeah. So back to this chapter. I'm going to repeat part of the line I quoted to start this conversation. Quote, that was an English tree planted by some expatriate in the hope of creating a memory of home, a living link to another life, unquote. And then, quote, she curled her hand around it briefly, wondering whether her own links had been severed for good, then let it go and turned to follow her father uphill. So at first I thought of the tree as representative of a different time and place. You know, England, So for this expatriate who planted it, it would have been a reminder of home, hopefully. And to her, a reminder, maybe a representative of her former life in the future, what she had with Roger or was wanting to have with Roger, etc. Or her former life with Roger, because she hopes to see him again, but she doesn't know that she will. So it could be a number of things or all these things. But as I see the times that Diana has used the tree thus far, it's been associated with Jamie and Claire and intimacy.
And doing it.
Intimacy, yes. All kinds, physical and emotional. It's definitely, at least in my mind, now associated with Roger and Bree and intimacy. So what do you think? Oh, Summer's answer to that is doing it.
Doing it. Oh, totally. I think... clearly I have not put that much thought into it as you did.
I did it till today. It's okay.
But I mean, I didn't search all of the books for mentions of horse chestnuts, obviously.
And conquer.
Okay. Point being is that for readers like me who don't delve as deeply as you do, for me, I thought that it was very representative of Roger. Of them, if she got it with,
yes.
If she collected it the last time they were together and she was angry about the way they parted, which is why it was burning her the first time, right? But now that she's cooled and tempers have cooled, now she's like, I wonder if this is all I'm ever going to have of him, right? Mm. So.
Well, yeah, it definitely makes sense. If now we know, because in chapter 41, when she recoiled from it, you're like, what the hell, Brie? What it's a conquer? Who gives a conquer? What the hell, right? Or a hole of this horse chest? What's the big deal? Well, it did not occur to me. I did not remember that was the tree that they were sitting under, and that she had picked one up. I didn't. Who remembers that? They're all Megan Whoopi. That's what we remember. Anyway, so Diana definitely, you know. You had to do a tiny bit of work, but Diana definitely leaves big clues there for you if you look. Cindy R. writes, I wonder if Jamie is taking Brianna on this jaunt merely to spend time with her alone, or perhaps to show her the wonder of this place and her mother, the place that he and her mother call home. Regardless of the reason, Diana's description of the forest and how it awakens as sunrise nears is so beautiful. I agree. I just want to be in that place with them. Jamie has brought Bree to a place with large boulders. And they're like, as soon as I hear or see or imagine anything with rocks, I'm like, and Brianna has to wave her hand in front of the rock back and forth just to be safe. And then Jamie's like, uh-oh. He hadn't been thinking of that at all. So that was a little bit of humor there. They agree that the emptiness of the moors and glens in Scotland are inhabited, not as empty as this place. Because they sit in the silence of the place and talk about, or both kind of agree in that this place also, just like Scotland, this place has its own spirits. Jamie says he thinks the spirits that live here are thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, and that they haven't seen their type before. And I think by that he means like translucent white people with red hair, but or just Caucasians, Europeans, whatever.
At first, I didn't know where you were going with that. You were like translucent, and I'm like spirits, like ghosts, and then you're like red haired white people. I was like, okay.
No.
Make fun of the pasties.
And Brianna thinks the spirits are curious as well. Cindy R. writes, they make a connection regarding the difference between Fraser's Ridge and the Highlands, how the spirit of the ridge is different than the spirit of the Highlands, despite them both being open, lonely spaces. I feel that this is the first link that they share other than Claire. And of course, their identical red hair. Now, Brianna asks Jamie if he minded living in the cave for those 7 years near Brochmorda. And he says he hadn't. She shares how Ian, her uncle Ian, had taken her there to show her where he had lived. She says that Claire also doesn't mind being alone. So both of her parents, Jamie and Claire, sometimes out of force, being forced or out of necessity, sometimes not out of necessity, sometimes by their own will, have been alone or are alone, and they can handle it. Jamie wonders what Claire had gone through living with a husband all those years, that she would know such aloneness. So Jamie was physically alone. I mean, spiritually or emotionally a little bit too. I mean, he had God with him, of course, and he had his family, but his family was, although they were so close, they were, you know, physically apart because of the danger that it would have brought on all of them for him to be living with them, literally. So he was physically alone in that cave for the most part. Claire was like the opposite. She was not physically alone, except for, you know, when she went back to school. But Claire, while not physically alone for 20 years or about 20 years, was emotionally alone, definitely lonely. So they both had different types of aloneness. But
don't we think Claire's was almost worse?
I think so, because Jamie says, and we'll get to it, but Jamie says that, you know, it was like I may not have taken notes from that part, but Jamie says that it wasn't ideal. He wouldn't have chosen it, but he loved Scotland. He loved the scenery. He loved nature. And so
I love that what he said was like, you know, once you realize you're not going to die from loneliness,
exactly,
you step on. But what I mean about it being worse for Claire is that she was never alone, but it's almost worse to be in a room full of people and still feel alone. You know what I mean? Mm.
Mm-hmm. Cindy R. writes, the discussion of being alone is interesting. I appreciate Bree's concern for Jamie's time spent in the cave. When Jamie assures her he didn't mind being alone, actually enjoyed the peace of solitude, Bree opines that maybe that is why Jamie and Claire get on so well. When Jamie says perhaps that's true, many times a person who, quote, cannot bear the sound of their own thoughts, unquote, doesn't always make a match with someone who does. I feel she's concerned that Roger's difficulty in understanding this concept of being alone confirms they are not meant for each other. Jamie picks up on her tone here, and his jealousy from earlier when she first mentions Roger eases a bit as he picks up on her doubts about Roger. Jamie then wonders how Claire, married to Frank for 20 years, had drunk deep enough of loneliness to know, unquote, the flavor of solitude. It makes me wonder yet again just how much Claire has held back regarding her time with Frank. Has she told him anything about her suspicions of Frank's infidelity? Obviously, she's not discussed enough with Jamie for him to see that time for her as one of much loneliness and isolation as he had experienced. Okay, we learn that Brianna had told Jamie and Claire about her search in Scotland, her search around in general, the death notice, her travel to Scotland, visit to Lallybroch, and about Roger. Now, even here, after getting Claire back and Randall being dead, Jamie says that Frank had won. Quote, Claire was his. So was this glorious child. He had had the keeping of them for 20 years. There was no doubt he had set his mark on them. But what mark had it been? Unquote. And of course, he's talking about Frank. Martina P. writes, Jamie knew he could ask Brianna about Frank and Claire's relationship. He could also inquire about the meaning of Claire's comfort with solitude, but he simply would not do so. Sometimes we just don't ask the question because we're afraid of the answer. Sometimes it's just better not to know. I think this is the same here with Jamie. Having both Claire and Brie in his life now, he cannot help but wonder what mark Frank Randall has left on both of them in those 20 years. In my mind, Jamie's moments of jealousy are totally justified. What do you think, Sam?
About his jealousy being justified?
Justified. What do you think about Jamie feeling this way or feeling a way?
They're justified. There's a part of me that's just like, dude, you're going to have to get over it. You're the one who sent them away. You know what I mean? It's like, you can't, it's not... And it's not like detrimental jealousy. It's just that like pang of what would have, what could have been, what, you know, and a feeling of loss of he got to do all these things I didn't get to do. So yeah, it's totally justified. But again, he brought it on himself.
Well, I think it was. So I think Martina has a point. Sometimes there's a question which you are completely I don't know if I have a right to answer. You definitely can ask. You definitely can ask. And you probably would get an answer. Whether it's an answer you want or don't want, or whether you just don't want to tempt fate. Because as long as you don't have a definitive answer or an answer from someone who really knows better, knows the truth, as long as you don't have that answer, you can always, the jury's out, right? You can always kind of wonder.
Well, not only that, but if he asks Claire, she might spare his feelings.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think that Bree will. Not that she's, above not, sparing his feelings. But I think she'd be probably more honest than Claire would be.
And I think so. But I also think that along the lines with, being afraid to ask the question or just not only potentially being afraid of the answer or not wanting to hear the answer, whether it placated him or not, or, helped his, saved his feelings or whatever. I think for him to ask a question related to Frank, especially one that is related to his, that might answer his wonderings about that mark that Frank had on the two loves of his life. I think that even hearing her talk about Frank, even if Bree did placate him or tell him, say spared his feelings, just hearing Bree talk about Frank, I think is like daggers in his heart. I don't know who it's harder to hear from Claire mentioning him or Brianna mentioning him. I think both. I don't know. I honestly can't answer that.
Honestly, I think that the things that he learns from Brianna would probably hurt him more.
Yeah.
Because she is telling him the things, because her experience of Frank was as a father, not as a husband, mm-hmm. which means her experiences with Frank were the things that Jamie should have done and that Jamie should have been able to experience with her.
Yes. And also, they were not clouded by what might have been. All Bree knows is the wonderful father she had. All Bree knows of Frank is the wonderful father that he was to her. She's not clouded by adultery or potential adultery. She's not clouded by, Whereas Claire did have, to the much as very little time together, she knew Frank. She loved Frank before she, fell through. And then, of course, she met Jamie, fell in love with Jamie, and then had to go back to for their her and her baby's protection. And Frank was a mensch. He did. He stepped up. He stayed with her, helped, and he fell in love head over heels with Bree. So that relationship was completely pure. But so I just think there's probably more than one or two things. But I think the reason he probably didn't ask, number one, is because it was Brianna rather than Claire, even though he probably wouldn't have asked Claire. And I agree with you. She would have definitely not hurt his feelings on purpose, but she would have answered very truthfully without, maybe gently, but very truthfully. And she was not going to disparage her beloved Frank, because Frank is like a hero to her. She was not going to disparage him. And not that Jamie wants her to disparage him, but he was, if he hears anything, especially if he...
Oh, he secretly hopes.
Oh, sure.
He secretly hopes. I mean, he wants her to have had a fantastic childhood, right? But there's also, I'm sure, a little part of him that's like, hey, I got one over on Frank.
Well, I just think that, like you said, for him to ask her, she is head over heels with Frank. Very unobjective about him, understandably so. And he's like... he's not a god, but like parent, when you grow up, your parents are, when you're really young, they can do no wrong. And I think, especially since he's died, that's like a sacred thing to her. There was no way she was going to speak ill of him. Not that he wanted her to, but there was no way. And so I think having her tell him something about things they did or even their relationship or her mom's relationship with Frank, I just think Jamie's like, you know what? I'd rather wonder, because number one, there's the knowledge, right? There's the knowledge that would upset him or whatever. But even having to hear about it, hear new information about Frank, even if it's completely positive, twist that knife in his heart, in his back, just a little bit more. Again, not that anyone betrayed him purposefully, like evilly, but there's that 20-year separation that they just will never get back. And there's this guy who raised his child that he will never get back. So hearing about it, even if it's positive, is more of like a, you know, turning that knife in his belly. And I just think he's like, you know, I just can't go there. I don't want to hear about it because then I'll have a new memory. And especially if it's positive, I'll have a positive memory forever about Frank. And that does not help. So I hear you. I hear you, Jamie. So they see two deer that are not afraid of them. In Scotland, Jamie says that never would have happened with a red deer. They knew the scent of man. Quote, he watched the deer graze with the innocence of perfect wildness and felt the sun's benediction on his head. This was a new place, and he was content to be alone here with his daughter. Unquote. So this is kind of another Eden moment. A new place, Eden. And What are they hunting actually? They are hunting bees. So I'm not going to go too hard, too long into like the whole Eden thing. It is a new place, but anything with the new world can be likened to Eden. Right? So that's, you know, easy to see. But this whole thing about being a new place, well, think about it. This is a new place, even though he and Claire have been there for like, you know, a year or two or something like that. This is a new place. This is a new world because now Brianna is there. You know what I'm saying? So whatever it was before, even if they'd been there 10 years, if Brianna came along, it is all new. It is all new. Maybe not the bed they're sleeping on, maybe not the cabin roof over their heads, but the fact that she is there means they're from here on out or for however long she stays, their world is new. Whether they're in this Eden-like place or back on the ridge, their world is new. So I really saw a lot of that. And then, of course, we get into the moon later on. It's just, this is so, she's packaged up so much in this chapter. It's really, really nicely done. So they're hunting bees. Okay, side note. So I think it was last episode I said something, I took a quote from it like I never do. I quoted some line and it was something like, I think it was the end of the chapter. Well, the very end of the chapter was no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. So that was funny. But just before that, there was a line, something about the something, something echoed in her bones. And I said, huh, you know, that's, I mean, I could be cutesy and say, ah, oh, remember that, dear listener. But no, I mean, it's not a spoiler necessarily. And it's definitely not something that won't hit you over the head. Book 7 is called An Echo in the Bone. So it's not a spoiler. I'm not talking about book 7, but I found that interesting. Okay. So then now this chapter.
Here's your bees. Yes. Go tell the bees.
Yes. So I'm not saying there's any connection at all. I don't think there is, except who knows? These might be the bees that are related to those bees. But I found it very interesting that two chapters in a row, there's Echo in the Bone is a lot closer than just the word bees. But it just made me think of, oh my gosh. So yeah, I just thought of book 9. Okay. So how to hunt bees. Well, they follow the bees until they find a hive late in the afternoon. And Jamie says that they'll wait until dark to get the hive. Now, while they wait, he lets her fire the musket he'd brought. And he is surprised to see that she's not a bad shot. And of course, as soon as that topic comes up, we're back to Franktown. He says to her, quote, where in God's name did you learn to shoot? Unquote. And she says, quote, my father was a target shooter. He taught me to shoot with a pistol or a rifle, a shotgun too. Unquote. So what do we have so far? Frank has taught her or has made sure she has learned to ride horseback. And to shoot. Probably camping skills, probably, you know, fishing, gutting a fish, cleaning a fish. I don't know. I don't know exactly. But definitely horsemanship and shooting. Now, without, I mean, you have to mention him, but without spending too much time talking about Frank solely, again, I have said, and I said it in our fan panel, I think both years now at Comic-Con, that I am... It is completely titillating. Completely. As much as I want the last two books, I want the whole story. I want all the stuff. I want all the bulges. I want the Ellen and Brian story. I want everything. But I want outside of books 9 and 10, I want nothing more than what Frank knew. Because he to me is the most, not exciting. He's the most mysterious character. And after book 8, your mind will explode if you haven't read that yet. And so now that, you know, Diana does hint at things. It's not even a hint. This is flat out telling us some things happening or happened. We don't know what, and we may not figure out unless Diana writes that book. But in the 1950s and 60s, I don't believe it was that common in Boston for young ladies of, you know, upper middle class to learn how to shoot. I mean, maybe like, you know, dressage, like equestrian stuff, I could see. But she was like learning horseback riding and shooting, and that's just not that common today, nor was it back then. So it's a huge, I can't say hint yet, maybe, but it's a huge red flag, or at least a huge flag, as to why in the hell would Frank want his daughter to participate in these very potentially dangerous activities? Why? And remember, he died when she was 18. So she did all of this growing up. I think she said something about either the horse, probably not the shooting. One of them, I think, when she was like 9. So it's crazy town. So without getting into Frank too much more, does this stuff interest you too?
It does. But on my first read through of these books, I just assumed he was a sporty dude.
Summer. Oh, Lord.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I accept that. But remember, he was a spook, a spy. And once a spy, always a spy. Just going to say that and I'll leave it there. And he would have had, even as a spy, MI6 or MI5, whatever he was in, even as a spy, he would still have had, you know, formal training in firearms, right? As like someone going through the regular military would.
You're not wrong, but British people are totally different than American people.
Huh?
I said, you're not wrong, but British upbringings of that time period were completely different than our experience growing up in this time period. So in my brain, I made it totally logical that he would have taken her shooting and hunting and like sporty.
I don't see a natural, or I should say obvious, reason for him to make sure that she learned how to ride and learned how to shoot. It's not a bad thing. It's not, you know, he absolutely could have come up with that. But I just think if you remember Frank's background during the war, especially, and then these things, and we learn more later on, I'll say not. And you really don't hear a lot about this until book 8, so I'm not trying to like belabor it, but oh, if you haven't read it, oh my gosh, speed read, because that stuff, I still have to do like, we have to do a live someday, because that just like, oh my gosh, that just floats my boat. Okay, so Jamie tells Brianna the plan for how he's going to remove the hive and then wrap it up, and then sort of seal it, wrap it up, and then take it home and post it somewhere. Cindy R.
Repost it? This
isn't like
the internet.
Post, like with a nail, post it to the wall. Cindy R. writes, "The bee hunting escapade is delightful. Jamie's explanations are humorous, and him giving Bree a daisy gave me a heart squeeze. I can just picture the two of them darting around flowers chasing bees. Almost like two little kids chasing lightning bugs at dusk. When Bree asks if the bees won't be upset in the morning to have been displaced, he asks, what will they be able to do about it, as they will have no way to find their way back? He says that they will be content to stay. I make a little parallel to Claire here. Displaced from her home, her own time, she had very little choice but to adapt to it."
I mean, it's an awful lot like Dorothy Gale in Wizard of Oz. You know, they just pick up the whole house and move it, and then you're in your new place.
It was a long journey to being content, though, she says. So as they wait, Jamie asks her if men did end up making it to the moon, as Claire had told him that they were attempting to do. Bree shares that yes, they did, and the rocket was called Apollo. And Apollo is, of course, is the name of a Greek god who was the brother of the goddess Diana. As Brianna, and of course, the moon goddess Diana. So that's very fitting. As she describes the moon landing, the barrenness of space, etc., Jamie says, quote, "It sounds like Scotland." Martina P. writes, "I always enjoy the moments when Claire or Brianna tells Jamie about the future. Bree tells Jamie about the moon landing, and Jamie tells her about the old ones. It is amazing how well they already know each other in such a short time. I love how Bree realizes how much he misses his beloved Scotland." Cindy R. writes, "Jamie's acceptance of Bree's description of the moon landing and description of the moon's surface speaks to the trust he holds in both herself and Claire. How extraordinary it must seem to him, how strange the world his wife and daughter lived in must seem to him." Then they get the hive and start back home. And we are then transported to the ridge, back to Claire's point of view. They're back, and Jamie's not able to sleep. He says he's sorry that they must lose her. Quote, "You can't really lose a child," unquote, she says. So that was a really quick switch. So they make it back. They take care of the bees. Later that night, because it's actually past dark, it's past night, they go to bed. And Jamie wears a shirt out of deference to Bree, so for his, you know, so he's not exposing his naked, half naked, manly body, whatever, to his daughter. And he goes to bed and he can't sleep. And they're talking. This is something that we have not been privy to, but you come to understand what they have discussed or decided. So they agree that Brianna can't stay. Brianna needs to go back to her time. She sticks out too much.
Has Brianna even told them why she came back?
She's told them about Roger and everything. Yeah.
No, but about the fire?
Yeah, I just mentioned it earlier. The death. Okay. She does the search. She tells them about the death notice and everything.
Okay.
So they've had a conversation off page that they agree that Brianna must go back. And so right now what they're saying is they're kind of lamenting that. They know it's best, but they're like, "I'm going to miss her." And Claire says, "You never really lose a child." Cindy R. writes, "If Bree knew that Jamie likened her to Louis to Louis camel, she'd likely punch him in the nose. I don't care how splendid and stately that camel was. I would not want to be referred to as such. And I don't think she would either." So what she's referring to is in their discussion of how Bree does not belong there, they likened her to this camel they saw while walking the garden at Versailles when they were in Paris. This camel, like King Louis owned all these exotic animals, and seeing a camel in the middle of the garden of Versailles was just like ridiculous. It just did not, it just stuck out. Poor animal. Just, it stuck out. It was, did not belong. And that's why he likened Brianna to the camel. So they agree that Brianna will have to go back to the future. Claire mentions Faith. She reveals to Jamie that she had taken her pink tulips when they had gone to stay or to see Jared. Now, I'm guessing this is the time in Voyager before they left for the New World, because that's the only time that makes sense, because when they left, when they were in Paris originally and then left to go, or in France, and then left to go back to Scotland before the Rising or for the Rising, they didn't, that we know of, they didn't go back to the cemetery. But it makes sense that they, when they went to go see Jared, I'm guessing it was in Voyager, that she went to go visit the grave and she brought her Faith pink tulips. And Jamie says that he had taken violets to her grave.
No. Well, then did they not see each other's? One of them should have seen the other one's flowers.
That's true. But you don't necessarily know whose they were. And they were a few days away from each other. They could have been taken away by the nuns or something. Claire is sorry that Jamie never got to see Faith. And she says, quote, "Yes, it doesn't matter what happens. No matter where a child goes, how far or how long, even if it's forever, you never lose them. You can't," unquote. And then, quote, "The breeze stirred the air above us with the sound of angels' wings, and we fell slowly asleep together as the moonlight bathed us in its ageless peace," unquote. So lots of moonlight here on Jamie and Brianna, Jamie and Claire, and of course the entire discussion about the moon landing and how desolate the moon was.
So if they adapt that, I'm going to need Bear McCreary to not play Faith's theme during that because
I know. Because you know
but
he will.
I'm going to need to get through that scene, so I'm going to need him to not play it.
Martina P. writes, "This chapter reminded me so much of the one when Jamie took Willie fishing. He finally has the opportunity to spend a day with his child, doing and teaching things he is passionate about and very good at. I so adore both chapters and love that Jamie has this opportunity he never dreamt possible. What a blessing for a father and so heartwarming. Treasured moments for Jamie of a time when he teaches his son how to fish and his daughter how to hunt. In both cases, he does not know how much time he will have with his child. My heart breaks for Jamie each time."
So which one of them do you think is a better son?
Willie or Bree?
Yeah.
Summer. "We get another precious moment," this is Martina continued, "toward the end of the chapter when Claire and Jamie talk about their two daughters. They both know that they will lose Brianna, and Claire says that you can never truly lose a child just like Faith, who will stay with them forever. They both tell each other how they brought flowers to Faith's grave. Jamie took violets, which symbolize faith, mystical awareness, the subconscious, inspiration, spiritual passion, profuseness, and sovereignty. Claire brought her pink tulips, a symbol of caring, attachment, and good wishes. A truly delightful chapter, full of emotions and true love." Cindy R. writes, "I feel the title of this chapter, Moonlight, is very fitting. Jamie and Bree watch the moon rise, and Bree tells Jamie of the moon landing that happened recently in her time. I think it can also be used as a symbol to shed light on Jamie and Bree's burgeoning father-daughter relationship. It makes me think of when Jamie had to take Willie away to avoid the measles. He was able to have alone time with his son and share some of the things he enjoyed, like fishing. He now has a similar experience with Bree, hunting. It's touching to see that he's able to have these times with his children. It's probably something he never thought to have, and it makes me so happy for him." And finally, Cindy R. concludes with, "Jamie and Claire sharing that they both left flowers for Faith when they had last been in Paris is so heart-tugging. How difficult it must be, again, to fathom losing another child with the thought of Bree needing to return of the future. The description of the breeze stirring above them with the sound of angels' wings harkens to mind Faith's presence, signifying, as both Jamie and Claire had said, that once you've had a child, you never really lose them. The last line of the chapter, with them falling asleep, as the, quote, moonlight bathed us in its ageless peace, perfectly rounds out the chapter titled Moonlight."
And that was chapter 42. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapter 43 entitled Whiskey in the Jar. And as always, if you want to join us to continue the conversation, come on over to Facebook, to our Facebook group. Direct link, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/group.
If you love our show and are entertained by it, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You can find that at patreon.com/outlanderpod. There are also a number of free ways to help support our show, the most important of which is to help spread the word. Tell your family and friends who love Outlander about the Outlander podcast. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.